Furthermore, among Biden's first presidential acts was to abolish Trump's advisory 1776 commission, which was established to enable a rising generation to understand the history and principles of the founding of the United States in 1776 and to strive to form a more perfect union. The commission's first responsibility is to produce a report summarizing the principles of the American founding and how those principles have shaped our country. Prior to Biden's swearing in, the commission issued the 1776 report, which was immediately disparaged by the media. On January 19, 2021, NBC's Chuck Todd and MSNBC's Tremaine Lee refused to even dig into the contents of the report on air before ridiculing it. Their commitment to the critical race theory ideology was obvious. Todd: "Well, look, we've seen it even in sports, what Deion Sanders wants to do at Jackson State and sort of break some of those barriers and reestablish a lot of ways for HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. I know one of the things we wanted you to do was talk to students at the university to see what their reactions were about the banner that said 1776. Lee: "Yeah, Chuck. We talked to a political science professor who said it's really just the response to 1619, and it's really based in a fiction, hypocrisy of America, that there's no way to disentangle slavery. To present this kind of shoddily slapdash, it's a shock to no one, quite frankly, because they've been on this for quite some time." Todd: "It's both a shock and, sadly, I don't think we were surprised." Todd, Lee, and the other media personalities toe the party line. By this I mean they do not and will not break from the group think and ideological imperatives of the various Marxist-spawned movements. They are mouthpieces for and enforcers of ideological purity, true believers for the various intersecting Marxist-centric causes and belief systems, and mostly loyal members of the Democratic Party. There can be no disagreement or deviation from the party line, and for the most part, there is not. Delgado and Stefanchik remind us, like Marcuse before them, that in the end, if a peaceful transition does not take place, given the white establishment may resist an orderly progression toward power sharing, particularly in connection with upper-level and technical jobs, policies, agencies, and government, what comes next, as happened in South Africa, the change may be convulsive and cataclysmic. If so, critical theorists and activists will need to provide criminal defense for resistance movements and activists and articulate theories and strategies for resistance. Or a third, intermediate regime may set in. Whites may deploy neocolonial mechanisms, including token concessions and the creation of a host of light-skinned minority middle managers to stave off the transfer of power as long as possible. This is a truly dangerous, unhinged, racist movement. The group Black Lives Matter, BLM, is a product of the fusion of Marxism and CRT. In a 2015 video interview with Jared Ball of the Baltimore-based Real News Network, one of the three co-founders of BLM, Patrice Cullors, declared that she and fellow founder Alicia Garza were Marxists. Cullors stated in part, "I think of a lot of things. The first thing I think is that we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia Garza in particular are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on ideological theories, and I think that what we really try to do is build a movement that could be utilized by many, many black folk." The third of the co-founders is Opal Tometi. Meanwhile, BLM Marxist Con Cullors has acquired four homes worth several million dollars. She published a best-selling book and signed lucrative deals with Warner Brothers and other companies to promote her radical agenda. Few Marxist revolutionaries and sympathizers live as they preach. And there is ample evidence tying the BLM Global Network, the overarching organization, to violent Marxist anarchist movements of the past. The Heritage Foundation's Mike Gonzalez notes that Cullors trained for a decade as a radical organizer in the Labor Community Strategy Center, established and run by Eric Mann, a former member of the Weather Underground, the 1960s radical faction identified by the FBI as a domestic terrorist group. The Weathermen explained in their 1969 foundational statement that they were dedicated to the destruction of U.S. imperialism and the achievement of classless world, world communism. Gonzalez discovered a seminar in which Mann lectured attendees to ask themselves, "Am I making decisions to change the system? Am I being tied to the masses?" Moreover, Mann noted that the university is the place where Mao Zedong was radicalized, where Lenin and Fidel were radicalized, where Che was radicalized. The concept of the radical middle class of the colonized people, or in my case, the radical middle class of the privileged people, is a model of a certain type of revolutionary. Take this country away from the white settler state, take this country away from imperialism, and have an anti-racist, anti-imperialist, and anti-fascist revolution. Scott Walter of the Capital Research Center explains, "If there were any question whether Black Lives Matter has ideological ties to the communist terrorists of the 1960s, the story of Susan Rosenberg should put that issue to bed. BLM is ideologically tied to the point of having Susan Rosenberg on the board of the Central Group with trained Marxists with a history of extremism and violence. In fact, Rosenberg was a member of the May 19th Communist Organization, M19. Rosenberg had a long, violent criminal record as a Marxist revolutionary, for which she served 16 years of a 58-year sentence until her full pardon by Bill Clinton." Gonzalez notes that Rosenberg is vice chair of the board of directors of Thousand Currents, the radical grant-making institution that until July 2020 sponsored the BLM Global Network. Rosenberg was also sought on federal charges that she aided the 1979 prison escape of Joanne Chesimard, a communist now living in Cuba. Rosenberg and Mann, as well as Barack Obama's former associates Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, were all associated with the Weather Underground. Britannica explains, "The Weather Underground, originally known as the Weathermen, evolved from the Third World Marxists and was a faction within Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, the major national organization representing the burgeoning New Left in the late 1960s. Furthermore, as part of its earlier mission statement since scrubbed from its website, BLM called for the dissolution of the nuclear family. "We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement for supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable." Neither the original mission statement nor its subsequent scrubbing was by accident. Marx believed that the nuclear family was a manifestation of bourgeois society. Like religion, the nuclear family interfered with the kind of social ideological brainwashing necessary to achieve the Marxist paradise. Thus, he attacked it and called for its destruction. "Abolition of the family," even the most radical flare-up at this infamous proposal of the communists. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital, on private gain. In its completely developed form, this family exists only among the bourgeoisie. But this state of things finds its complement in the practical absence of the family among the proletarians, and in public prostitution. The bourgeois family will vanish as a matter of course when its complement vanishes, and both will vanish with the vanishing of capital. Do you charge us with wanting to stop the exploitation of children by their parents? To this crime, we plead guilty. But you say we destroy the most hallowed of relations when we replace home education by social. And your education, is not that also social and determined by the social conditions under which you educate, by the intervention, direct or indirect, of society by means of schools? The communists have not invented the intervention of society in education. They do but seek to alter the character of that intervention and to rescue education from the influence of the ruling class. The bourgeois claptrap about the family and education, about the hallowed correlation of parents and child, becomes all the more disgusting the more, by the action of modern industry, all the family ties among the proletarians are torn asunder and their children transformed into simple articles of commerce and instruments of labor. In the meantime, countless corporations, grant-making, non-profit groups, athletes, actors, and business executives, among others, provide tens of millions of dollars in financial support to BLM. Democratic Party mayors name streets and boulevards for the organization, and BLM is celebrated and even lionized throughout the culture and media, drawing support from countless individuals, especially young people. As the Marxist critical theory ideology and propaganda spread throughout academia, the media, and beyond, so do the number of movements associated with it. For example, another significant and growing movement is the Latina/Latino critical race theory, LatCrit, which, as Lindsay Perez Huber, a postdoctoral scholar at UCLA, writes, involves experiences unique to the Latina-Latino community, such as immigration, status, language, ethnicity, and culture. A LatCrit analysis has allowed researchers to develop the conceptual framework of racist nativism, a lens that highlights the intersection of racism and nativism. The overarching theoretical frameworks are CRT, and in particular, LatCrit. CRT in educational research unapologetically centers on the ways race, class, gender, sexuality, and other forms of oppression manifest in the education experiences of people of color. CRT draws from multiple disciplines to challenge the dominant ideologies such as meritocracy and colorblindness, which suggest educational institutions are neutral systems that function in the same ways for all students. This framework challenges these beliefs by learning and building from the knowledge of communities of color whose education experiences are marked by oppressive structures and practices. The efforts of revealing racism in education is a conscious move towards social and racial justice and empowerment among communities of color. To understand LatCrit, one must understand race and racism, that is, as with CRT generally, the nature of white supremacy and the white dominant culture. Understanding racism as a tool to subordinate people of color reveals its intent as an ideological function of white supremacy. White supremacy can be understood as a system of racial domination and exploitation where power and resources are unequally distributed to privilege whites and oppress people of color. Indeed, writes Huber, one can be victimized by racism despite the reality of whether or not any real differences exist. Racism is defined as the assigning of values to real or imagined differences in order to justify white supremacy to the beliefs of whites and at the expense of people of color, and thereby defend the right of whites to dominance. Furthermore, in defining racist nativism, Huber declares, historically, perceptions of the native have been directly tied to definitions of whiteness. Beliefs in white superiority and historical amnesia have erased the histories of the indigenous communities that occupied the U.S. prior to the first white European settlers. Whites have been historically and legally deemed the native founding fathers of the U.S. With this important connection between nativism and whiteness in mind, racist nativism is defined as the assigning of values to real and imagined differences in order to justify the superiority of the native who is perceived to be white over that of the non-native who is perceived to be people and immigrants of color, and thereby defend the native's right to dominance. Stefanchik asserts that Latino/Latina CRT has been around for half a century or so. Its progenitor was Rodolfo Acuna, who was the first scholar to reformulate American history to take account of U.S. colonization of land formerly held by Mexico and how this colonization affected Mexicans living in those territories. His thesis has proven as powerful for Latinos as the potent theories of Derrick Bell have been in understanding the dynamics of race for blacks. Therefore, not only is the United States a white-dominant, systemically racist society oppressing all people of color, but the country's very existence is illegitimate due to its colonization of Mexico's land. Hence, the true natives are the indigenous Mexicans, not the whites, who promote racist nativism. Acuna's 1972 book, Occupied America, opens, "Mexicans, Chicanos, in the United States today are an oppressed people. They are citizens, but their citizenship is second class at best. They are exploited and manipulated by those with more power, and sadly, many believe that the only way to get along in Anglo-America is to become Americanized themselves. Awareness of their history, of their contributions and struggles, of the fact that they were not the treacherous enemy that Anglo-American histories have said they were, can restore pride and a sense of heritage to a people who have been oppressed for so long. In short, awareness can help them to liberate themselves. In other words, being the true natives, Mexicans and Chicanos ought not assimilate into an Anglo-American culture. The former are oppressed, and the latter are colonialists." But Acuna's dire assessment respecting the condition of the Mexican population in the United States cannot explain why Mexico is the top origin country of the U.S. immigrant population. In 2018, roughly 11.2 million immigrants living in the U.S. were from there, accounting for 25% of all U.S. immigrants. Why would millions of Mexican citizens leave their home country to migrate both legally and illegally to America, in some cases risking life and limb, only to be exploited and manipulated? The fact is that they are escaping oppression, poverty, crime, and corruption in their own countries for a better life in the United States. In their book, Navigating Borders, Critical Race Theory Research and Counter-History of Undocumented Americans, University of Arizona professor Ricardo Castro Salazar and UK Durham University professor Carl Bagley proclaim that scholars have repeatedly pointed out that U.S. people and their leaders tend to be chronic ignorers of history. This amnesia becomes damaging when it forms the boundaries of inclusiveness in modern narratives of U.S. identity and citizenship. The quotidian narratives of history and current events in the United States overlook that America encompasses two continents and includes Argentinians, Brazilians, Canadians, Colombians, Cubans, Dominicans, Guatemalans, Haitians, Jamaicans, Mexicans, Salvadorians, Venezuelans, and many other nations traveled by European explorers in the 1500s. In a proclivity for simplification and abbreviation, many U.S. people, United Statesians, have forgotten that the United States is of America and not the other way around. The United States is located in Northern America, but has shaped the realities of Central and South American nations. Thus, the argument goes America is bigger than the United States, encompassing two continents, and the United States and its majority white European-linked population, namely United Statesians, are the true trespassers. Indeed, Mexican-origin Americans have a greater claim to United States territory than American Anglo-Protestants, according to Castro, Salazar, and Bagley. They write, "Ironically, undocumented Americans of Mexican origin have a double American identity, United Statesian and Mexican, and possess a stronger historical connection with the American continent than the majority population in the U.S. People of Mexican origin, meaning those with a blend of indigenous and European heritage, lived in the lands that are now the southwestern United States, centuries before U.S. expansionism dispossessed Mexico of half of its territory. Those who perceive Mexican origin Americans as a threat to American Anglo-Protestant identity do not overlook this. They fear that no other immigrant group in U.S. history has asserted or could assert a historical claim to U.S. territory. Mexican and Mexican Americans can and do make the claim." In applying CRT to the discussion about what Castro, Salazar, and Bagley define as undocumented Americans of Mexican origin, they argue that CRT holds that all knowledge is historical and therefore biased and subjective. Their critical theory of society rejected any claim to objective knowledge and focused on uncovering the oppressive mechanisms of society. The purpose was to understand such mechanisms in order to develop conditions that would allow the oppressed to free themselves. Therefore, illegal aliens are neither illegal nor aliens, and are actually the victims of internal colonialism, that is, the conquered group is dominated and controlled through various means, including violence and more subtle attacks on the subordinated group's culture, language, religion, and history. Consequently, there is opposition and resistance to assimilation into the American culture by a host of racial and ethnic activists, the culture of Anglo-Protestant identity, or the white dominant culture for which they are taught to have complete and passionate contempt. And what of Latino Americans who reject this ideological fanaticism? Again, echoing Marcuse and his repressive tolerance theory, Castro, Salazar, and Bagley claim that the phenomenon becomes more complex when the colonized internalize the colonialist mentality and become part of the colonizing majority. In a pluralist capitalist democracy, those who have internalized the oppressor's mentality can become part of the colonizing structure and support many of its actions. Thus, Mexican Americans and other immigrants who assimilate into American society have been snookered by or sold out to the colonizing white majority. Castro, Salazar, and Bagley declare, "Internal colonialism is a form of inegalitarian pluralism, where different ethnicities and cultures coexist, but ethnic relations traditionally follow an assimilation model, like in the United States. It is also a form of racism, where the dominant culture views the colonized ethnicities and cultures as alien and inferior, as in the case of Native, African, Asian, and Mexican Americans in the U.S. Internal colonialism exists in the United States with or without the intention of individuals, and can be found in all dimensions of life. Internal colonialism contradicts the notion of an integrated and democratic society where some researchers argue political and economic inequalities are not temporary, but necessary for the industrial capitalist system. The dominant society does not see such contradiction, which perpetuates their privileges. Hence, according to Castro, Salazar, and Bagley, assimilation and capitalism promote targeted oppression and inequality against minorities by the supposedly white-dominated society. As with his embrace of CRT soon after his swearing-in, Biden signed 5 executive actions unilaterally changing immigration policy, all of which were sympathetic to and supportive of the Latina/Latino critical race theory, LatCrit, movement. Among other things, he ended construction of the border wall, later continuing construction of a mere 13.5 miles, ended the Trump interior enforcement policies, instituted a 100-day deportation moratorium, and proposed amnesty for individuals without legal status. Moreover, Biden ended agreements the Trump administration had secured with Mexico and other Central American countries to send asylum seekers who arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border to one of 3 Central American countries. The result, as reported even by the Biden-supportive Washington Post, the new president began tearing down some of the guardrails instituted by the Trump administration. Biden issued 5 immigration executive orders on Inauguration Day alone and promised an immigration policy far more humane and welcoming than that of his predecessor. His administration also began allowing unaccompanied minors into the country, a marked departure from the Trump administration's approach. The situation at the border, which Biden and his advisors steadfastly refused to call a crisis, is the result of an administration that was forewarned of the coming surge, yet still ill-prepared and lacking the capacity to deal with it. Administration officials have been plagued by muddled messaging, sometimes making appeals that seem directed more at liberal activists than the migrants they need to dissuade from coming to the country. Biden and his transition team were warned early on by federal immigration officials that their initiatives would overwhelm the border and the immigration systems, but Biden ignored them. The Post report, "During the transition period, career officials at U.S. Customs and Border Protection tried to issue sober alarms to the Biden team about the likelihood of a crisis at the border that could quickly overwhelm the nation's capacity. Senior Customs and Border Patrol, CBP, officials delivered Zoom briefings to the Biden transition team that included modeling projections showing a steep increase in the arrival of unaccompanied minors if Trump's policies were suddenly lifted, according to one current and two former Department of Homeland Security officials. What was missing from this report was that Biden's decisions were in line with the Lat-Crit movement's view of immigration, to which he was appealing. Overwhelming the immigration system and border security forced significant numbers of CBP officials from their border enforcement duties and had the effect of creating an open, unmanned border. Untold thousands of immigrants were released into our country without even receiving court dates for asylum hearings, and others had the coronavirus, among other diseases. Therefore, rather than defund CBP, a policy pushed by Marxists within the Democratic Party and Lat-Crit activists, but which would not have received sufficient votes in Congress, the Biden administration simply changed the immigration and border dynamics by executive fiat. Alas, as Lat-Crit preaches, there really is no such thing as United States sovereignty because America is bigger than just the United States, and besides, United Statesians are the real interlopers. Those crossing the border by the hundreds of thousands are the actual indigenous Americans. Moreover, the Democratic Party hopes to benefit from embracing the movement as it counts on wave after wave of illegal aliens and subsequent grants of amnesty, as one of the ways in which it seeks a permanent hold on power. As Pew Research has reported, Latino voters favor the Democratic Party by a significant margin. Jim Clifton, chairman and CEO of Gallup, asks, "Here are questions every leader should be able to answer regardless of their politics. How many more people are coming to the southern border? And what is the plan?" There are 33 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. Roughly 450 million adults live in the region. Gallup asked them if they would like to move to another country permanently if they could. A whopping 27% said yes. This means roughly 120 million would like to migrate somewhere. Gallup then asked them where they would like to move. Of those who want to leave their country permanently, 35%, or 42 million, said they want to go to the United States. Seekers of citizenship or asylum are watching to determine exactly when and how is the best time to make their move. In addition to finding a solution for the thousands of migrants currently at the border, let's include the bigger, harder question. What about all of those who would like to come? What is the message to them? What is the 10-year plan? 330 million U.S. citizens are wondering. So are 42 million Latin Americans. The plan is linked to the CT Marxist ideology. That is, the more migrants the better, continue to overwhelm and collapse the system, change the nation's politics, demographics, and citizenry, and ultimately transform the nature of the governing system. And by no means support or accept assimilation. After all, balkanization and tribalization are certain to destroy any country. Another of the intersectional movements that have also grown into powerful political forces involves gender, critical gender theory. As with other CT movements, at the heart of this movement is the claim that the dominant society and culture, which see gender through the lens of a biological, empirical, scientific, and normative fact, have been oppressing the LGBTQ+ communities, which see gender as a social construct, where the dominant beliefs are simply the viewpoints and traditions of the privileged status quo at a given point in time. Therefore, virtually all traditional gender and sexual binary distinctions and related moral beliefs are considered oppressive, bigoted, and unjust. Moreover, a distinction has been developed over the last several decades between sex and gender, which historically were interchangeable in understanding and use. But no more. As Scott Yenner, professor of political science at Boise State University, writes, "Many Americans today have accepted what seemed inconceivable just a generation ago, that gender is artificial, is socially constructed, and can be chosen freely by all individuals. This notion that biological sex can be willfully separated from gender originated in the arguments of influential radical feminists writing from the 1950s through the 1970s. The premises of their theories, in turn, have ushered in the new world of transgenderism. Yesterday's shocking theory has become today's accepted norm, with more changes to come. Yet whether this new world will prove to be fit for human flourishing remains to be seen. Jenner explains that nowadays human identity is not determined by one's biology, genes, or upbringing. It is a product of how people conceive of themselves. Human beings are, on this view, unsexed persons caught in a body of one sex or another without any need to follow previous gender scripts. No more vivid example exists, writes the philosopher Roger Scruton, of the human determination to triumph over biological destiny in the interests of a moral idea. Indeed, we are told sex and gender orientation are more complicated than once thought. People often are unaware of the biological complexity of sex and gender, says Dr. Eric Villain, director of the Center for Gender-Based Biology at UCLA, where he studies the genetics of sexual development and sex differences. People tend to define sex in a binary way, either wholly male or wholly female, based on physical appearance or by which sex chromosomes an individual carries. But while sex and gender may seem dichotomous, there are in reality many intermediates. Academia, corporations, the media, and even the House of Representatives are adopting speech codes that eliminate pronoun distinctions between males and females. In the House, he or she would become member, delegate, or resident commissioner, and father and mother would become parent, while brother and sister would be sibling. Yet, Nancy Pelosi proudly and often reminds us, as do the media, that she is the first female Speaker of the House. ABC News reports that Facebook not only allows users to select from among him, her, or their, but also from 58 additional gender options. Agender, androgyne, androgynous, bigender, cis, cisgender, cisfemale, cismale, cisman, ciswoman, cisgender female, cisgender male, cisgender man, cisgender woman, female to male, FTM, gender fluid, gender nonconforming, gender questioning, gender variant, gender queer, intersex, male to female, MTF, neither, neutois, non-binary, other, pangender, trans, trans with an asterisk, trans female, trans with an asterisk female, trans male, trans with an asterisk male, trans man, trans with an asterisk man, trans person, trans with an asterisk person, trans woman, trans with an asterisk woman, trans feminine, transgender female, transgender male, transgender man, transgender person, transgender woman, trans masculine, transsexual female, transsexual male, transsexual man, transsexual person, transsexual woman, and two-spirit. And Facebook is hardly alone. As with CRT and Lat-Crit, a few hours after his inauguration, Biden signed an executive order reinstating an Obama-era critical gender policy, which states in part, "All persons should receive equal treatment under the law, no matter their gender identity or sexual orientation. These principles are reflected in the Constitution, which promises equal protection of the laws. These principles are also enshrined in our nation's anti-discrimination laws, among them Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as amended." But the Civil Rights Act of 1964 says nothing about gender identity or sexual orientation. It prohibits discrimination in public accommodations and federally funded programs, and bans employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Therefore, it is already a violation of federal law to discriminate based on someone's sex. In fact, Biden is explicitly laying out his administration's plans for instituting transgender ideology in every sphere of life, from schools, locker rooms, and sports teams, to healthcare and homeless shelters, wrote National Review's editors. Moreover, the executive order instructs the head of each agency to review all existing regulations where a prohibition on sex discrimination appears, and to apply the prohibitions on sex discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation from the Supreme Court's ruling last summer in Bostock v. Clayton County. This is overreach, plain and simple. In Bostock, the court explicitly restricted its decision to Title VII, stating that other policies and practices, such as bathrooms, locker rooms, or anything else of the kind, were questions for future cases. By contrast, the executive order takes Bostock's fallacious reasoning that discrimination on the basis of gender identity necessarily entails discrimination on the basis of sex, and applies it to any other statute or regulation that prohibits sex discrimination. In addition, the Biden Education Department switched sides in two lawsuits before the Supreme Court, reversing the Trump administration's support for the female athletes, one in Connecticut and another in Idaho, where the female high school athletes sued to prevent biologically male athletes who identify as female from competing in girls' sports. Thus, critical gender theory trumped both science and the integrity of female high school sports. In another executive order, Biden established a White House Gender Policy Council within the executive office of the president with broad and far-reaching authority. It is granted sweeping power to coordinate federal government efforts to advance gender equity and equality. Again, equality and equity are different things. The pursuit of equity, which is a result or end, often requires the unequal treatment of an individual or group to achieve. For example, the destruction of biological girls' high school sports to promote equity for biological males identifying as females. Nonetheless, the commission is directed to enforce the objectives of the critical gender theory movement as it applies to gender identity and sexual orientation. Do these Biden administration directives and actions apply to America's children? According to the Human Rights Campaign, yes. On its website, in a section titled Transgender Children and Youth, Understanding the Basics, the group states, "Children are not born knowing what it means to be a boy or a girl. They learn it from their parents, older children, and others around them. This learning process begins early, as soon as a doctor or other healthcare provider declares, based on observing the newborn's external sex organs, it's a boy or it's a girl. The world around the child begins to teach these lessons. Whether it's the sorting of blue clothes and pink clothes, boys' toys and girls' toys, or telling young girls they're pretty and boys they're strong. It continues into puberty and adulthood as social expectations of masculine and feminine expression and behavior often become more rigid. But gender does not simply exist in those binary terms. Gender is more of a spectrum, with all individuals expressing and identifying with varying degrees of both masculinity and femininity. Transgender people identify along this spectrum, but also identify as a gender that is different than the one they were assigned at birth." Michelle Critella, MD, and executive director of the American College of Pediatricians, a national organization of pediatricians and other healthcare professionals dedicated to the health and well-being of children, disagrees. "Transgender ideology is not just infecting our laws. It is intruding into the lives of the most innocent among us, children, and with the apparent growing support of the professional medical community." She adds, "Today's institutions that promote transition affirmation are pushing children to impersonate the opposite sex, sending many of them down the path of puberty blockers, sterilization, the removal of healthy body parts, and untold psychological damage." What does this have to do with Marxism? First, recall Marx's war on the nuclear family. As described by the Wiley Online Library, Marxist feminism is a species of feminist theory and politics that takes its theoretical bearings from Marxism, notably the criticism of capitalism as a set of structures, practices, institutions, incentives, and sensibilities that promote the exploitation of labor, the alienation of human beings, and the debasement of freedom. For Marxist feminists, empowerment and equality for women cannot be achieved within the framework of capitalism. Marxist feminism is reluctant to treat women as a standalone group with similar interests and aspirations. Marxist feminism thus distinguishes itself from other modes of feminist thought and politics by attending critically and systematically to the economic organization of societies, including stratification along the lines of class, by refusing to accord the category of women separate and special status, without regard to class, by its commitment to the overthrow of capitalism, and by its allegiance to working class and impoverished women. The International Socialism website explains, in part, the development of the forces and relations of production shaped and continued to do so in different ways, the impact that biology had on the position of women and the development of women's oppression. This connection between productive forces and family structure is not mechanical. Each new formation builds on what came before and is impacted also by battles between contending classes. Historical materialism emphasizes the particular historical circumstances in which the oppression of women, and later of trans people, emerged and developed. It allows us to look at the interplay between the biological and the social. The point is not to ask why trans people exist, but to defend unconditionally their right to their gender identity. Laura Miles, author of the book Transgender Resistance, Socialism and the Fight for Trans Liberation, and contributor to the Socialist Review, locates the origins of trans oppression in the enforcement of a greater rigidity of gender roles within the emergent nuclear family that arose around the time of another great transformation in productive forces, the Industrial Revolution. Women and children were pulled into the new factories alongside men, working in horrific conditions that resulted in a huge rise in infant mortality. The ruling class needed a reliable supply of future labor power, and some parts of the ruling class saw that this was under threat. Even if one does not accept a direct link or parallel to classical Marxist historical materialism and class theory, as with other CT movements, it need not be. The movements are said to be developed from or tailored after Marxist ideology. Indeed, that was the basis of Marcuse's adaptation. I would be remiss if I did not at least touch on the fact that children are being drawn into these movements and being programmed. Writing in the Washington Post, Natalie Jesionka declares that in the year of Black Lives Matter and Me Too, many parents are wondering when the right time is to talk to their children about social justice. Experts say it's never too early, and a new wave of tools and resources can help start the conversation. You can enroll in music class that develops understanding of gender and personhood. A drag queen story time will soon be a television show, and there are more and more children's books that discuss intersectionality and broaden representation, plus flashcards and short videos that teach parent and toddler alike anti-racism ideas. Lee Wilton and Jessica Sullivan, Skidmore College psychology professors who study race and social interaction, say that children develop implicit bias as early as 3 months old and at 4 years old are categorizing and developing stereotypes. With respect to critical gender theory, Andrea Jones and Emily Gao, in a Heritage Foundation essay titled Sexual Ideology Indoctrination, The Equality Act's Impact on School Curriculum and Parental Rights, explain, in recent years, activist groups have strengthened pressures on legislators and educators to require the teaching of radical lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender ideology in schools. They argue that inclusion and non-discrimination toward students who identify as gay or transgender require radical revision of curricula. Schools across the country and around the world have attempted to implement curricula that teach students the non-scientific belief that gender is fluid and subjective, and that traditional beliefs about marriage and family are rooted in bigotry. And the activism has reached into classrooms in an increasing number of states. Around the country, 5 states and the District of Columbia have begun mandating SOGI, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity, curricula in sex education and history, while 10 others have explicitly prohibited it. If Congress enacts a federal law, the Equality Act, it would usurp the state's authority on the issue and undermine parental rights. Jones and Gao point out that the powerful Human Rights Campaign, a leading activist organization, already asserts that LGBT students have been denied equal access to educational opportunities in schools in every part of our nation and explicitly draws comparisons to the Civil Rights Act's protections for characteristics such as race, sex, and national origin. I wish to make clear that I believe generally in the motto, live and let live. That said, many of its activists are outspoken advocates of CT and are making escalating demands on the imposition of their beliefs on the rest of society and the culture, including in classrooms and respecting ever younger children, United States Armed Forces, etc., by the force of government and law if need be. As such, this is less about tolerance and more about indoctrination, obedience, and the widespread institution of an affirmative agenda. Moreover, the intersectional connection with other CT movements and their Marxist roots is undeniable. As should be clear, the critical theory movement born and developed by German Marxists, chief among them the late Herbert Marcuse, is more influential in the Oval Office, the halls of Congress, university and college classrooms, public schools, corporate boardrooms, the media, big tech, and the entertainment industry, than the genius and works of Aristotle, Cicero, John Locke, Montesquieu, Adam Smith, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and so many others who contributed mightily to a civil and humane world. It is increasingly influential throughout the culture, too often at the cost of Judeo-Christian values and the lessons of the Age of the Enlightenment, which undergird the most tolerant, free, and beneficent societies, especially the United States. Instead, the intersectional network of a seemingly endless list of oppressed individuals and groups are obsessively committed to transforming and overthrowing the American Republic and society. That is, the dominant culture and its supposedly repressive institutions, and are tearing this country apart. Of course, this is not to say that every individual or group associated with these movements or their professed purposes is knowingly part of such a rebellion or revolution. No doubt many are unfamiliar with the ultimate objectives and motivations of the fanatical leaders, organizers, and activists among them. Nonetheless, they are contributing to CT's extremely destructive and revolutionary purposes and ends.